as mask mandates get lifted once again, folks are having spring fever instead of COVID fever. And although comedian Ben De La Creme is happy in a long-term relationship, her onstage persona is horny and ready to lay out the incense, wine, and candles for a very freaky scene. Yow.
Today, the White Out Bandit, Ben De La Creme, joins us to look at dating and commitment as we near the end of the COVID pandemic. Della's new show, Ben De La Creme is Ready to Be Committed, is coming to a town near you. And if it's anything like her critically acclaimed holiday special on Hulu, you know it's going to be a wild ride.
This one queen extravaganza is a hilarious and heartfelt spectacular that blends burlesque, comedy, and original music with her signature terminally delightful charm. And that's not just her press release saying it. We really mean it.
Plus, Ben De La Creme reflects on her controversial decision to walk away from one of the biggest drag competitions on television, RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars 3.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. You got it.
Okay, super freak.
Hello?
Hi, is this Ben De La Creme?
It is.
Della, es Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun.
Oh my gosh, hi. Hello to both of you. It's been so long.
I know.
It's been a while.
Yeah. You're the only person I know that has a French name with an epithet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, because De La Creme translates to from the cream.
Right? Indeed.
So Della is from the of the cream.
Yes. So of the is basically my first name.
But when we first met you here in Chicago, you were known as Tina Angst. Do you remember having a funeral for her?
Wait, a funeral for her? Oh, wait. Yes. Are you talking about Chances Dances?
Yes. You murdered Tina Angst on stage.
Yes. She died on stage. She was like stabbed by a bunch of Tina Angst impersonators.
Did you ever pay for that crime?
Almost forgotten about that. No, I was the victim.
Really, we're talking to the ghost of Tina Angst.
Yes, the ghost of Tina Angst was reincarnated into Ben De La Creme.
That's amazing. Because, you know, I mean, so many people are so, you know, tied up in their drag character. And it's just like, it's got to be this one character forever. But you kind of put that ego aside and you said, you know what? I'm changing this up. How did that come to be?
Well, it was literally the actual process of it. It was the only way that made sense in my head was that she actually had to be killed off in order for me to move.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a bitch, you know.
She had to go.
She was kind of a bitch. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I met you guys when I first really started Tina Angst, and she was kind of like a punky riot girl. And, you know, really, that was like, you know, her performances were all to kind of like La Tigra and Bikini Kill and that kind of stuff. And it really was sort of this outward manifestation of sort of my, I guess, frustration growing up queer and feeling like an outsider and then kind of entering the gay scene and still feeling like an outsider. And I think I just had a lot of frustration about that. And I felt like there was kind of a lot of negative energy that I was encountering as I came into gay bars. And a lot of that is like, you know, young people insecurity, like young gay men are bitchy as hell to each other. But, you know, one of the people that really inspired me to kind of change my persona was Miss Fousey.
Wow.
Queen of the pineapples.
Yeah. Yeah. Pineapple. She was like, she was so wonderful, and she would come into the space and she would say hello to everybody. She'd call everybody Pineapple. She was so sweet and welcoming. And, you know, it was like I realized that I had this kind of, like, I was so mad and I kind of had this persona that reflected that. And while a lot of people liked it and I think could relate to it on some level, it certainly didn't make anybody like nicer or happier. And then I would see these same, you know, like I would like it wasn't making me feel any other way, you know, mm-hmm. but then I would see these like same kind of people who were maybe kind of not like kind of catty or whatever with each other. When Miss Fousey would come in, everyone would just melt and everyone would become like kinder. And it was like, there was this maternal loving character that would come in, and it was like she was giving people what they needed, and that actually changed the energy in the room. And I was like, that's how you do it. You give people something loving and generous, and that's how you get it back. And so I decided that, you know, when I moved to Seattle, that I wanted to get a fresh start and kind of come at my character from a different angle. And that's sort of where it originated.
So you went from like an anxious teenager to like a Pollyanna.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, at this point in time, I mean, I've been doing Dela for over 10 years. And so she's got a lot more nuance for sure. But it was, you know, it's less about being a Pollyanna and more about just kind of a sense of generosity in terms of being out, like both like on stage and then just, you know, sort of out in nightlife. You know, I think that it really sort of redefined my experience within those spaces. And just, you know, I mean, I always have loved drag. I've always just wanted to perform and be part of that world.
Well, we all came of age like watching Pee Wee Herman, Divine, yeah, RuPaul, Mr. T, even Crispin Glover on David Letterman as their characters.
Yes.
Interacting as their characters at face value. So for a lot of us, when we started performing in drag, it was like expected of us to be this contained creature. And it was only until reality television and the internet that people started to expect to see you out of drag and talking about your character, your creation outside of you.
Yeah. You know, and that's really interesting because I still do, you know, my character is, I view her as very self-contained and different from myself, you know, because I do. Yeah. I mean, Pee Wee Herman, Elvira, they were such inspirations in that regard. And then, you know, there was a lot of, you know, drag queens who were just slightly my senior who were doing the same thing. I mean, Coco Peru, Varla G. Merman, right, Jackie, you know, I mean, they were also these, you know, some of those characters are closer to their real personalities than others, but they were still these kind of magical, larger than life creatures, like in the same way that, you know, a princess in a Disney park, it's like, you're not going to see her out of character. And that makes it sort of more magical. And so one of the things about going on Drag Race that I kind of struggled with was that I liked people getting to know the character and not kind of ruining the magic of that. But you're right. It's changed so much where people kind of expect to really get to know you in some sort of deeper level. But at this point, I just kind of think about it.
Do you want people to get to know you? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're like, I want some privacy or privacy.
Yeah, no, I do enjoy my privacy. I do kind of enjoy having my own space. And that's part, I guess, of having a separate character. But I'm also, you know, what it allows me to do is kind of talk about my artistic process. That sounds kind of lofty for a drag queen, but it allows me to kind of talk about that as the creator, kind of separate from the character. And so that part's cool.
Well, that's why I really appreciate, like, you know, the vehicle of Drag Race. My hesitation with Drag Race today is that it's really become a clone army.
Yes.
Yeah. But in the early days, the golden age of Drag Race, where you came of age, really introduced us to some really like visionary artists like yourself, who is willing to criticize and laugh at and poke fun of the ego, the creation that you've made. And so I feel like, you know, especially in the Jinx and Adela holiday special, there's all these really wonderfully cartoonish layers of irreverence and, you know, self-effacement, self-deprecation that makes it more than just a flat comedy. And I don't think a lot of drag queens understand that or even understand how to use that.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I was very inspired by a lot of really amazing character performers that came before me. And it is, you know, I mean, I also really think just like the, like what I love about camp and these large and these kinds of characters and this kind of like cartoony storytelling is that I think you can go some deeper places. I think people are more likely to come with you. Like if you can make people laugh and you can give them something sparkly to look at, you can kind of go into more depth and people's guard is down.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why we call the show Feast of Fun and not Feast of Responsibility.
Yeah, good branding choice.
Well, it was actually called Feast of Fools, as you remember.
Oh God, yes.
Yeah, and then was the publicist for the movie Milk balked at us wanting Dustin Lance Black on the show, and I was like, well, it's based on an essay by Harry Hay, and the publicist had no idea who Harry Hay was. And I was like, well, at this point, you know, why be attached to sort of something that can be interpreted as negative? Let's just create a doorway where everybody's welcome to celebrate and have fun. A feast of fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. You know, it's interesting as things get bigger because, you guys, like, your podcast blew up so quickly. And Feast of Fools, before that, it was... I mean, I think all of us, when we kind of reach this broader audience, we have to be like, oh, what's the language all these people speak in common? You know, it is like we all have our very specific references, but you have to figure out how to both maintain the integrity of what you're doing, but also kind of broaden to things that, you know, that more people can understand, which is great. It's great that you're talking to more people, but
yeah. Like the big tent, you know?
Well, and that's why I think it's really fun about a lot of your stage work that a lot of people who are, you know, deeply invested in reality television may not be aware of. And that's why it's so exciting to get you on the show, because I want people to see your work on stage because it's so different from what we've seen on television, except for the holiday special. I would say that's probably most representative of what you do. And you take this kind of like wholesome Americana. I mean, you've tackled the 4th of July, you've tackled, you know, the holiday season, and now you're trying to get married in your new show, Ready to Be Committed.
Oh, I thought Gracie's going to a mental institute. That's about marriage? Yes.
Well, it's both. You know, I was recording some music for it in the studio the other day because I was just kind of like freshening up some of these tracks. And the guy recording it was like, okay, ready to be committed, like marriage or like to an asylum? And I was like, both. Great. Okay, great. I'm glad the joke works, you know? But yeah, it's really fun. I mean, this is my fourth solo show, and it's the first time that I've really delved into this character dealing with like love and relationships. I've kept her pretty, in the past, it's all just, she's been pretty like asexual, you know, that's just not part of her that I've been super interested in exploring because she's, you know, it's like she's a little less than / more than human.
She's like in a Warner Brothers cartoon character. Like, we don't want to see Bugs Bunny having sex.
Exactly. Or, yes.
The humor is in him sort of seducing Elmer Fudd and then tricking him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of transphobic to some degree, but it's also like as kids, it was this universal language of like playing a prank on somebody was really, really funny.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's like there's, you know, you don't want to get too human with anything when you're dealing with this type of character. Yeah. So figuring out how to kind of talk about these topics within sort of the rules of her universe was really challenging, but like really rewarding because there is, you know, essentially the way that she comes at it is she, you know, the show starts, she's like, hey, everyone, thanks so much for coming. You're actually not at a show. This is my wedding. And then, you know, she's excited about the fanfare of it, but then realizes like, oh shit, I haven't gotten a cake, I haven't gotten a dress, and I haven't gotten a groom. And she has like 70 minutes to figure it out. And so along the way, she, you know, it leads down a lot of like very weird, cartoony, surrealist paths where she meets Cupid and like learns about sort of the history of how love has been classified by like philosophy. And she meets a group of gay men who have a reality TV show called Thayeth to the Dreth that's all about five gay men like falling all over each other because their only life's purpose is to dress a straight woman for her special day, you know? Mm. And then like she has an anthropomorphic plastic cake topper on top of her cake, who's like the bitchiest bridezilla, who's just like telling her she's doing everything wrong. And
so and you don't really actually like eat an actual wedding cake in every show, because that would get expensive.
That's just something I do for like specialty cities. It's just when the whim strikes me.
Well, you know what they do at weddings nowadays is they have a fake cake, right? And they have a section of the bottom layer that is an actual insert of a cake, a slice. And so the bride and groom slice that out, and that's what they eat. And then everybody else gets sheet cakes from Costco.
That's the stupidest garbage I've ever heard.
But you know what? It saves you a lot of money. It saves you a ton of money.
Well, it's and like you drag, want, you know, you save money by.
And if you want a nice wedding cake, don't tell them it's for a wedding. Just tell them you're having a 50th anniversary party for your parents or something like that. And your cake will be half the price.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. This is a good deal. I was like mad about less cake, but I guess I'm on.
Well, it's like putting birdseed in your bra, you know, it's about creating that illusion, not actually having
the birds come eat your
silicone in there.
Well, I'm excited too about your show. Your show's coming here in Chicago at Tally Hall on May 26th, which is a Thursday. Mm-hmm. And that's the start of IML.
Oh, shit. The
International Mr. Leather Conference. So expect lots of leather daddies and people in kink gear for your show. Unless they're going to be at the host hotel, you know, getting their groove on. But I would imagine a lot of people will come into town early to catch you.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite demographics. I love, specifically like a leather bear is really, I feel like, that's the group of people that generally resonate most mm-hmm. with my references, because mm-hmm. you know they're all like tough and in chaps and chomping cigars, but you know that they all know like every Judy Garland lyric. Yeah.
Do you want them to meet you at the stage door après le show?
Well, hopefully by that point, Dela will have already found a husband. So, I mean, we'll see.
Or a husband.
Well, are you dating anybody in real life? And are they like, should I be worried about my relationship with you? Or
am I? Oh, yeah. No, I've been with my partner, Gus, for 7 years at this point, you know? Aww. And so that's,
so when you were like on Grindr and Scruff, you were like doing research.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Well, you know, he loves what a nerd I am. And really, it's like, I always do. I mean, my shows always wind up being like, as you know, very ridiculous, cartoony. And I really, you know, it's like, I want to make people laugh constantly for the whole show. But it always, I have this weird period where I really am just like reading like academic books on like, you know, historical theories of love, and like reading like really boring, dull books by like straight women about how to plan a wedding, just because I like want to understand every aspect of it. And so, he loves that about me, because I really just make it like the nerdiest endeavor to make these ridiculous shows.
Is it tempting to sort of like want to get even in an argument by writing it into the show?
Oh, you know what? It really isn't, because I, it's that same thing we were talking about, where it's like Dela and I are so separate. And while I use things in my life to kind of inspire the beginning of these shows, I really want to write in a way that everybody can relate to. So I'm really, you know, with this show, I was really like aware that, you know, there's going to be single people in the audience who are happy to be single, not happy to be single. There are going to be coupled people who are happy to be coupled, not happy to be coupled. There are going to be people who have lost partners in their lives. There's so many, you know, and I wanted to talk about this in a way that would speak to everybody. And I think that's, you know, I like to, you know, I mean, when I knew you guys, I was at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And I have to say, one of the most valuable things that I learned there was to start making art from a personal place, but then to broaden it in a way that really considers that people can't always relate to your specific story. You have to put it into a language that is for everyone.
You and I went to the same school.
Oh my God, I guess I'd forgotten that.
I had no idea. I mean, I've known you all these years.
I read it in your Wikipedia.
Who are your teachers?
Do you remember any of them? I don't remember.
You're like, I'm still paying the bill, but
do you remember? Do you remember how drunk I was back then all the time?
You were a delight, and I don't want to throw any shade.
I'm a very fun drunk.
No, but it, like, even, you know, as Tina Angst, like, one of my favorite performances that you did is you were doing "Love Is a Battlefield." And you had an inflatable guitar that you start playing, and the guitar starts to deflate, and so you're trying to inflate the guitar as you're performing it, and then you just start fucking the guitar.
Who doesn't love a good blowjob and fuck on a?
It was brilliant, and you know, and you had this wonderful, visual humor. Like even now, you know, certainly like with the holiday special, Varla Jean Merman plays your grandmother's spirit haunting an eggnog drink, right? Am I getting that right?
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. And now you're having, you know, like a lot of these puppets sort of are, I don't know, like, are you having somebody off stage doing the voice, or are you having this pre-recorded and you're just trying to stay on cue?
Yeah. So actually, you know, I've been doing this particular technique when I do it live on stage. I've been doing this particular technique of puppetry for a really long time because I love to play all these characters, and there's a lot of characters in the show. So some of them are me playing them on screen through like interactive dialogue. So it's like pre-recorded, but I script it super tightly and just have the timing down, so it feels like a pretty natural conversation. And then the same thing with the puppets. It's like I do all the voices, I pre-record them, and then I just have like a really skilled tech person that I travel with, and we just get into the rhythm where it's like he's hitting those cues, and it feels like a really natural conversation. And it's, you know, it was tricky at first, but now it's kind of, it's in my arsenal as just one of the things I am pretty good at. So it's fun.
How did you approach Varla Jean Merman to play the eggnog in your holiday special?
Oh, well, you know, Varla has been somebody that I have loved and admired for so long. And we got to know each other for the first time. God, I always say everything is 10 years ago. It can't always be 10 years ago, but I would say around 2008 is when I started performing in Provincetown. And she, of course, has been a Provincetown staple for forever. And
she hides in the bushes and goes like, go see the Varla Jean Merman show.
That's how she used to bark. I mean, she doesn't bark anymore because everybody knows she's the ticket to buy as soon as you get there. But, you know, at the time I was started doing shows there, and you know, I was working with a burlesque troupe, and there were like five of us, and sometimes it was a 1-to-1 ratio with the audience. You know, it's like that was how it started out. And she came to one of the shows, and I have never been so nervous in my entire life. But she was so sweet and generous and kind, and it took me a couple years really of her inviting me to lunch and spending time with me before I was fully comfortable. But you know, now we're like,
I heard the reason that she wanted to invite you to lunch so that you could poison your beverage
or eat you. mean,
it's possible, but for whatever, I must have drank out of the wrong glass, because you know, at this point we've become very close, and we talk a lot, and you know, I have told her so much about how she inspired me, and she's adopted me as her drag daughter, which is really fun because I never had a drag mom. And I mean, when we wrote this character for the film, it was a no-brainer. It was like, that's who had to play this character, because she's hilarious, she's got like the vocal characterization skills, but also the show is all about like queer family and chosen family. And everyone in that cast, all the dancers and Varla included, are part of my queer chosen family. And so that just felt like the right fit.
It's such a wonderful show. And you know, I'm dying to see you being committed.
Well, thank you. I'm excited excited to bring it. And I hope that I'd love to have you guys at the show in Chicago.
Well, if there is a list, put me on it.
I'll consider yourself listed.
Consider yourself invited forever. Before
you stay the weekend too for IML.
Stay for IML. Well, she's got a tour. She's going everywhere.
I gotta pop off to the next city. I'm in Glasgow after that. I've got to go to the UK.
Oh, really?
Damn, honey. She worked half of the money, so you better treat her right. Before we leave off, in hindsight, you know, because every your most notorious moment in, you know, for a while is eliminating yourself on All Stars 3.
Yes.
In hindsight, you know, do you have anything to add that hasn't been discussed already on this? Like, do you still feel like this was a good decision, or were you like,
I mean, I've time, talked about it so exhaustively, which makes sense because mm-hmm. it was like, you know, a high profile thing, but I've talked about it a lot, but yeah, I mean, I still think it's one of the best decisions I ever made. You know what I mean? It was so empowering in terms of like, you know, just being there and being like this, you know, I want to be here. I want to participate in this, like, you know, the Olympics of drag. I want to show what I have to offer. I love drag. I love getting to do these challenges, but I don't agree with the importance of this elimination system. I don't think it's necessary for the entertainment value. And so just having that moment of realizing like, holy crap, I can have my cake and eat it too, was so empowering and honestly really shifted how I went about a lot of things in my life afterwards. I like, you know, I had like working and personal relationships in my life that I thought I had to hold on to that were kind of not working for me. And I was like, you know what? I don't need that. I stopped saying yes to gigs that I didn't really want to do and started being bolder about asking for what I wanted. And kind of my whole career started kind of sky.
And so do you carry a bottle of Whiteout with you now wherever you go?
I do, yeah. I just like anytime I'm not into what somebody's saying, I just jot their name down real quick and show it.
I love it.
Ben de la Creme, looking for love in all the wrong places. But she found it. You know?
She found it.
Yeah.
Well, he's still looking. You're going to have to go on her journey. He found it, but we'll see where she finds it.
Well, you know, is there a difference between Mr. T and Lawrence Theroux? What is his name? Or, you know, Paul Rubens and Pee Wee Herman and, you know, Cassandra Peterson and Divine. And, you know, as Annie Sprinkle said, and you're familiar with Annie Sprinkle, she says,
yes,
after a while, she realized, you know, it was just a reflection of her. This truer self to some degree.
I mean, I think there's a lot of that, but also like, you know, there's, I mean, if you ever hear Paul Rubin in an interview, he was a different person. And Cassandra Peterson just came out as a big old les, and you know, Elvira's been lusting after the gentleman for years. So
we knew this a long time.
Now when people Everybody say, knew. How's your head? She's going to be like, well, I mean, what's she gonna say now?
Rusty. A little rusty.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Della.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure talking to you. See you in Chicago.
Yes. Take care, love.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ben de la Creme lives in Seattle, Washington. Her new solo show, Extravaganza, Ben de la Creme is Ready to Be Committed, is coming to a town near you, and of course, for Chicago, for Memorial Day weekend. So lock up your daughters, lock up your sons, your non-binary children and trans children, and get them ready to have their lives changed and go get some tickets. bendelacreme.com.
She's got multiple shows in San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and then all over the country and in the world.
In Glasgow. In Scotland.
Glasgow is lovely.
Which is part of the European Union, but the other part isn't.
I don't
isn't.
Know how it works.
People over there.
No, because they're part of the UK, so.
I think parts of the, yeah, some of them are part of the European Union and some are not.
I don't know.
Don't hold me to it, honey. I don't have Wikipedia in front of me. What do you, you know, it is great to see this kind of like auteurship. Mm-hmm. You know, because Ben puts a lot of thought, a lot of artistry, a lot of intellect. You know, I hate to combine the word intellect and comedy and show together, but it really, there's a lot of layers, a lot of beauty into the work that she makes.
And they borrow from, you know, the burlesque scene too, very much so, as in their performances as well. So that's very exciting to see that kind of stuff.
And for people who are not familiar, like, how does that look like, or how does that
manifest? Well, you know, it's hips and boobs ass. And movements and, you know, it's sexy, but it also can't be fun, right?
Yeah.
So.
And, you know, although Ben de la Creme, I call, you know, I've always called her Ben, but the proper name is Della.
Della.
Which means from the.
If you're referring to, I think it's more like Della.
Della.
Like Della. Della Reese.
Oh, Della Reese.
Yeah, but Della. Della.
Yeah, Della.
But Ben, if you're referring to the, you know, everyday, ordinary soul.
But she's part vampire because she has not aged a day. I mean, I have photos of her and us, and I look like I'm 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks exactly, maybe the drag just kind of hides the flaws. And when you're bringing, you know, drag race bucks, mm-hmm. maybe you can afford a little bit of a filler or, you know, they're like, you can write it off taxes, that lip plumping, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so much easier to apply makeup when you have like a fuller face or you don't have wrinkles. Right.
Right.
So, you know, these queens are all like, they're Botox at the age of 22.
Yeah. They're like, I got to get a career. I got to go on Drag Race. I need that Botox.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I got to buy this beauty palette.
If you ever want to be shady to an older queen or something like that, you send them like makeup techniques for older women.
Oh my God. That's terrible. Well, it's like Lady Bunny one time told us in a backstage interview, she said, it's like, oh, RuPaul's been telling me for years she's been Botoxing her face. So I said, where and why did you stop?
When and why did you stop? Oh, honey, I've been Botoxing for years.
That's what, I've been Botoxing for years, honey.
Well, when and why did you stop? When and why did you stop is a good question to ask anybody about anything at any time.
Yeah. Just like, I've been singing for years. It's like, what'd you stop? I've been taking lessons for years, you know, and that kind of thing. And you're like, why you?
You have to practice your shadiness.
I'm sorry, but you have to understand that Mark's idea of humor is a brilliant comment delivered with impeccable timing.
Listen, I want to thank everybody for listening. If you'd like to go back in our archives, you can listen to some of our other podcasts that we did with Ben, where we talk more extensively about drag and Drag Race and Tina Angst.
And all the queens from the golden age of RuPaul's Drag Race, you know, before it became like a clone army. You're like, which 400th clone of Trixie Mattel are you to now? But, you know, it is everybody has a different voice and a different path and a unique spirit and definitely worth celebrating. And we're glad that we've been able to do this podcast for so long and talk to so many amazing people like Ben de la Creme. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's made possible because of you, you fierce, beautiful, fabulous person. You can go and listen to all our archives, including our interviews with RuPaul and many of the winners of RuPaul's Drag Race, mm-hmm. and many of the contestants, the villains, the heroes, mm-hmm. the scamvestites. listen to them at the beginning of their careers, at the height of the celebration, and you can do so by going to feastoffun.com/plus and listen to all those archives.
Also, join us at Patreon at patreon.com/feastoffun for an ad-free podcast experience.
That's right, Holling. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Fausto Ferno.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.